Hi guys, it's Andy McDonald, physio and strength and conditioning coach, and welcome to the Informed Performance Podcast. On today's show, I have the pleasure of speaking to Stefania Bell, who is a physical therapist who has had the extraordinary career transition from an extensive clinical background into becoming a well-known injury analyst and senior writer for ESPN. Within this episode, we'll be diving into the hotly debated topic of playing turf and how it affects both injury and performance, but even more interesting, how turf is now being objectively assessed. So you're in for a really interesting episode today. If you're listening to this episode and you're a physio or physical therapist wanting to upskill your strength and conditioning education, or perhaps you're a strength and conditioning coach wanting to learn more about injury-specific approaches, then definitely check out our new Strength and Conditioning for Rehab Professionals course online. As we know, clinical education does not cover high-performance sport, and typically, strength and conditioning education does not cover rehab. So to bridge this knowledge gap, myself and seven expert presenters have created a course that covers essential and in-depth S&T topics in a rehab context that you can apply with your athletes and their rehab process immediately. The course includes expert contributions from an amazing lineup including Matt Jordan, Ben Ashworth, Dan Howes, Jonas Dodu, Eric Mira, Scott Morrison, and Jesse Wright. So if you're looking for a more applied and contextual place to learn about strength and conditioning for a rehab purpose, then join us on this online course. Today's episode of the Informed Performance Podcast has been sponsored by Vald Performance, makers of the Nord Board. The Nord Board has become the gold standard for assessing field-based hamstring strength. By combining advanced sensors, real-time data visualizations, and cloud analytics, the Nord Board helps practitioners to accurately measure, monitor, and train individuals' hamstring strength or imbalances. To learn more about the Nord Board, visit our sponsor, voldperformance.com. You're listening to the Informed Performance Podcast with me, Andy McDonald, and here is today's guest, Stefania Bell. Stefania, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm definitely self-conscious of this episode because I've realized that I'm actually talking to somebody that talks shop for a living. So I'll be taking notes for how you present today.
Well, now you've made me nervous.
As is kind of tradition, can I get you to walk us through your background? Because yours is definitely quite different.
Yeah, and I'm of a certain age that I actually, with the background is long now, you know, that's the thing. So I'll try not to make it too long, but feel free to ask me anything else if I haven't given you sufficient information. I'm a licensed physical therapist. I mean, my professional career started with me as a physical therapist. Went to the University of Miami for graduate school. So Princeton undergrad. And actually that's where this journey really started because I was a French literature major who was also pre-med, and I worked in the training room there as part of what they called work study back then, when you had to work hours to help contribute to your scholarship. And I found an opportunity in the training room, and I just liked the idea of it being sports medicine sounding, but I didn't really know what happened there. And it was through working with the physical therapists there that it really made me decide I wanted to go into PT. I had originally thought I'd be an orthopedic surgeon, but I love the fact that they saw the athletes every day and they were out in the field with them every day, and that you got to watch the rehab process daily versus kind of these pit stops along the way. And the orthopedic surgeons do their best work when the patient is out cold. So I wanted more interaction than that. And that's how I ended up going into PT. Went to University of Miami, got exposed to manual therapy there. And that in my final semester, that really, I loved it. I was like, oh, this is cool, because there's so much you could do with your hands. And so I really wanted to gain more knowledge in manual therapy. And I sought out my first job at Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco for that reason. They had the manual therapy fellowship affiliated with Kaiser. I knew I could get training on the job, and they encouraged it. I mean, back then, if you can believe this, one day a week was spent in class with instructors from the fellowship program. And then the other 4 days you treated patients. So the fact that they gave us that kind of time and then we had mentoring while we were seeing patients was phenomenal. And I think advanced my career, my skill set so much early on for being in that environment and just being around the fellowship students as well, who are always reading and learning, and the clinical faculty, just a great environment. And I like the academic side. So I wanted to be able to do a little bit of teaching as I got a couple of years into my job as PT. And it just so happened that one of my former professors took a job as the chair of the physical therapy program at University of Kansas. And I had never thought I would move to the Midwest. He'd been one of my professors at Miami. But I really wanted to take advantage of the opportunity. And so I did. And it was, you know, it was a great move. Like, I've just been very fortunate. Every decision I've made has helped launch me somewhere different and given me opportunities I never would have expected. So went there, was teaching the program and working in the sports medicine clinic, and the director of the sports medicine clinic left pretty abruptly. And so I found myself running the sports medicine clinic as well. And it was great because we worked alongside the physicians there. And then the guy who was basically the head of the sports medicine clinic there was also the head football team physician for University of Kansas. And for people who don't know where the medical center is, where the med school and physical therapy program and all that were based, is Kansas City, but the school's in Lawrence, like a half hour away. So we would go to the training room at Lawrence and I would see patients with him and get some of the more complex cases. So I did consulting for a lot of the D1 athletes in the off season. They would come up and rehab with me. It was a great sort of trajectory towards sports medicine, but I also was doing an orthopedic manual therapy residency at the same time and teaching. So all of that, you know, 5 years there just kind of accelerated that phase of my career. Wanted to move back to California. That's where I'm from. Took a job in the Bay Area where I was outpatient supervisor, basically a clinical specialist, and also had an opportunity to teach now back in the manual therapy fellowship that I'd been exposed to when I was first practicing. So I got to teach there. I was teaching at Samuel Merritt College, which is also a professional PT program. And then clinical mentoring. And in the process, we were building out a sports medicine specialty area. It's too long to explain how the Kaiser system works here. That would take a whole podcast. But within the region of Northern California, at least at the time, there were different specialty areas. And really in the South Bay, it was not considered sports medicine-y at all. I mean, people didn't, like, kids who went, high school athletes there didn't go there. They went elsewhere. And we had hired an orthopedic surgeon who came out of Birmingham and done his fellowship with Andrews. And I was there when we helped decide to hire him, but I hadn't been there that long. And he and I just kind of developed a sports medicine practice there. And it was phenomenal. And that was really, we built it so we became recognized as a sports medicine center for all of Northern California. He's now the head team physician for the San Jose Sharks. I don't think as a baseball guy, he ever thought he'd get into hockey, but look, we never know where we're going to end up. But the idea that we could turn a place that was pretty general orthopedics into a sports specialty practice. And obviously it was only a subset of what we did there, but it was very much my subset, all while I continued manual therapy practice. So you know, those are sort of the pit stops along the way. But then I had this love for fantasy football, which I played, and people started asking me a lot of injury questions. And I thought, you know, there's something to that. I love sports. I've always been a huge sports fan. And at the same time, I had also, starting in Kansas City, started doing some consulting with touring performing artists. And it started with Alvin Ailey Dance Theater when they have a second home in Kansas City. So these dancers, but they didn't have the money to have somebody to travel with them. And surprises a lot of people that some of these established theater companies don't have someone of their own, but they don't for the most part. And so I would bring other top manual therapists in to treat those patients. And I loved it so much. And when I moved back to California, I did it in San Francisco for all the major theater houses. So the combination of treating athletes from, I had kids all the way up to professional, a lot of professional athletes in the Bay Area. And then the performing artists subspecialty group and the teaching, kind of all of that rolled together. I really like the idea of talking about injuries and explaining them to people. And when I played fantasy football, there was a thirst for injury information and not really anywhere to go get it. And so one thing led to another. Again, that's quite a long story, but I just started meeting people, talking to people, and people liked the idea of someone like me giving information, but everybody told me nobody will ever pay you to do it. And I don't think that I've ever responded really well to like, never, nobody, you know, this can't happen. And I just saw that there was interest in the information. I thought, there's interest in the information, I can turn this into something. And so little by little, I started writing, and that kind of expanded to working for a company called RotoWire. And this was while I was doing all my other stuff. I mean, nobody was offering me any money of any consequence. Let me be very clear. I mean, it was more that they were giving me space to write. And I basically worked for free on this for a couple of years till it started to get noticed. And then this guy I had met through the fantasy sports world, Matthew Berry, who's now, you know, he's probably the face of fantasy football, but his website had been purchased by ESPN. He knew who I was. He was trying to build out the staff there. And he brought me in because I was a writer. That's the word, the literature major, you know, the writing all through college came in and helped me out. And I had this unique angle. And there were very few women in fantasy sports at the time. So all those things, I think, made me intriguing to ESPN. I got a 6-month contract, temporary, and I've never left. And now I'm going on 17 years at ESPN. So it's kind of crazy how things happen. I ended up moving out to the East Coast to be closer to the job, but I always felt like I could parlay this into something bigger than fantasy sports, but really just being somebody who represented the area of sports medicine. And I say that very loosely because I also a certified strength and conditioning specialist during my, time as a clinician. And I feel like the umbrella of sports medicine is so much bigger than just what people maybe think of traditionally as medicine, but we've gotten, you know, as you well know, so much into prevention and recovery and just the whole spectrum of team members who touch an athlete when it comes to health and wellness. So anytime there's a topic like that, that I can get into for us, I do. And so that's sort of where I am now.
No, great. And a great clinical background.
I said that it was going to be short and I totally lied to you, but I was trying to do this is your life as fast as I could.
No, but it answers the question. And I can only imagine that for you, you're on ESPN and you don't get a long enough leash to say, I'm a physical therapist, sports medicine, this is my background clinically, and then send them a message. No. So I can imagine a lot of therapists just have no idea what your actual clinical background is. So it's really interesting to get the full context for once, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's true because it used to be that they always fonted us, or people would say, Stefania, you're a licensed physical therapist. And now it's just, you got to get in too fast. And I get it. And I've been there long enough now. They still have these little, markers they'll put below our name sometimes, but most people don't see it. So there's a lot of people who are like, believe me, by the way, if you ever dream of working in, this format in public eye, you just have to be prepared for everything that comes with it. Plenty of comments. So there are often people now who will say, well, what qualifies you to talk about this? So not everyone knows the background. Yes.
No more. So you're obviously a PT now functioning within a very large media platform. And I think probably most clinicians can relate to the profession of physical therapy, at least having frustrations with its limitations, autonomy, and many things. Everyone probably cares about different things. But not everyone's kind of able to speak out and stick their neck out and risk public opinion, or at least they won't want to. how do you, as someone who kind of works in the media space, how do you think clinicians can truly advocate or influence the profession in terms of the things that may annoy them?
Don't start off by saying what annoys you.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, that's usually looking for a fight. I mean, it's just interesting. I think, you know, when I got into this world, social media didn't really exist. Twitter launched while I was working at ESPN. So I worked for a few years without Twitter. It was just that people could say things on the internet. It used to be that I had a blog page, or we had chats. We did a lot of live chats. And so people could comment and say whatever they want. So you learn pretty quickly that people would not hesitate to say whatever they want. But it wasn't in that social media space. Now it's Twitter. So it gets blasted out to the world, or X as it's now called. Or whatever your chosen space is, but those things get broadcast to a large community. And so everybody had to learn pretty quickly that everything lives forever. You know, once you say something and put it out there, that comment can be, you know, picked out and pulled back and thrown back at you years after the fact. And so I think there's been an adjustment for those of us who are a little bit more senior. And just having to evolve with social media coming into being. I think younger clinicians are probably much more adept at maneuvering around social media because they grew up with it. So they grew up with the comfort of it. I think for both groups, it can be problematic if it's not navigated well. Again, with the idea that everything you say sticks around forever. And also, I think as time has gone on, you know, I don't think people are as civil in their discourse as I would prefer it to be. I mean, I think when I grew up in the area of constructive criticism and feedback and having done clinical mentoring and having taught for years, there a lot of what you're taught as a teacher, professor, you know, supervisor in the clinic, even working with patients is how do you give feedback so that it's well received? I mean, you can still provide direction and you can still provide critique, but how do you do it in a way that doesn't immediately put up the defenses? And I think this is my way of getting to answer your question, but I think that's really critical because I think when people start by this is what's wrong with, you know, what you're doing, or this is why I don't like, or this isn't the way to go, it immediately puts up the roadblocks. People, human nature is to get defensive. So I think inviting people into a conversation, and I think we need to challenge ourselves in how do you get a dialogue going, or how do you get a conversation going? Because you have to recognize too that just because you think something is right, doesn't mean that it is. I mean, of course, I always think I'm right. but you have to be open to the idea that you can have a dialogue about something. So I think my recommendations would be start in a smaller, safer space for you, whatever that is. If you're somebody who's comfortable with social media and you've been out there the whole time, you know the pluses and the minuses of it, then go ahead and start somewhere like X and have a conversation. But I think, you know, even in a group chat or amongst friends or a work group conversation or team, I think that's a good place to start if you want to experiment with, like, I want to put something out there that might be a little bit controversial. And I know people are going to have different opinions. And here's, you know, where I'd like to start the conversation. I think you set the tone by being professional in how you present something. Like I said, my preference is I can share my opinion where I know I will be disagreed with. And by the way, we're recording this on a day where the NFL just approved a rule to eliminate the swivel portion of the hip drop tackle. And I am hugely in favor of this. And it is not a popular opinion. So I've just been, you know, taking my own advice in this dialogue that I'm having on social media right now, where it's something that's not popular. So how do you share the information and why you think this is a good idea in that space? And then I think you expand from there. I tend to set my own rules for the conversation being civil. You know, when you get into name calling. And I know I'm talking about it from social media at large, but I've actually seen this within the medical community too. And I don't like it. I just don't like it. I think, we can disagree. If there's something that's truly offensive, I'll bow out of the conversation. But I think I've seen attacking on social platforms sometimes where either someone dismisses somebody else's thoughts in a pretty impolite way, or the tone just deteriorates from something that's professional and civil. So to me, those are the rules of engagement. And if you're not willing to abide by them, I'm not engaging with you. And that's sort of a self-protection thing, as well as I think that's where I prefer my conversations to live. And then I think as you get more comfortable doing it, you can expand the space within which you operate and maybe take a chance on talking in public, you know?
Yeah, I think even for our profession, we kind of live in the era of it's easier now than ever to build a personal brand. So if you're a facility owner, a consultant, whatever kind of realm you're in, I can see how people, not necessarily rightly, but I can see how people view people that have different views to theirs as taking money off their table, so to speak. But that doesn't make it right. I think it gets taken out wildly out of context.
The other thing, you know, it's true. Like you said, I think people are more comfortable building their own brand. So, if you're doing that through social media means, you are speaking and there's not anybody talking back to you. So I think sometimes people forget how to have the back and forth, because it's like, this is what I think. This is what I'm saying. Look at me. I mean, there's a lot of that. And I don't think that's all bad. I mean, one of the criticisms, especially in my profession in physical therapy, is that we're terrible self-promoters. And I was too until I worked in the media. And even now, I'm not nearly as skilled at it as I wish I was. But I've gotten much, much better over the years, because you recognize that you have to do that to some degree to survive. So I think there's a balance between trying to self-promote, but then also understanding that you can share the space with other people, and that's not the end of the world, and that there's room for a lot of people with differing opinions. There, it doesn't mean that I think all things are equal. I mean, there's places where I want to draw a line in the sand. I'm not in agreement, perhaps, with somebody else's approach, and I will state it more strongly when I feel that way. But I think there's still ways of being polite.
Yeah, no, well said. A bit of a tangent, but I often think there's maybe a parallel that exists between what you do at times or what you have to be able to do, and moments where, say, a director of performance or head of rehab has to be able to find the best, consultants, surgeons, and third-party support for their team or their athlete, maybe in rehab or something. So to speak, you've got your kind of finger on the pulse with who's who and where they are. Beyond a basic answer of networking, how do you stay current and in the know of who's out there?
It's you can't do it without the networking. I definitely think that's part of it. But I think it's just one of those. I used the word Rolodex the other day, and somebody made fun of me because they're like, it's funny. Not everyone knows what a Rolodex is anymore. But
metaphorical Rolodex, yeah.
But as just over time that expands, so your network, your virtual network of people who you know and trust, is naturally just going to grow over time. And so when those people make recommendations, I automatically have, if somebody whose opinion, whose position, whose experience, whose judgment I really respect and trust directs me to someone else, then automatically they've passed a level of vetting, so to speak. It's true, because as you talk about, like in my world, I get pitched a lot of things. So things will come across my inbox of, you should look at this and do a story on X, Y, or Z. This is the best, and, you know, and they're marketing people whose job it is to promote something for their client. So, if, you know, maybe an athlete is using some device, and this is now the best thing that's going to cure everything. And it, you know, some marketers are very good, and you could easily be drawn in, but I like to vet things out. And so I start doing my own research, but I often go to some of the people who I trust. So to your point about how do you find them, it's a combination of things. I mean, just because you have the biggest social media profile doesn't mean that I necessarily think you are the best person at that skill set. Some of the people who are the best really have no social media profile. Maybe they're either not really interested in doing it, or they keep a very low one, I should say. You know, they are so invested in their craft that if they get acknowledged, they'll maybe share some of that on social, but they're not, their goal is not to brand market themselves above and, you know, above all else. I like to research people's background and training. Another thing, over time, I've taught a lot. So I pay attention to what's going on at different programs. Who are the faculty at different programs? What are they teaching? What are they researching? Where did somebody train? For orthopedic surgeons, I look at where did they do their fellowship, because I know people who teach in the different fellowships, and I know the quality. Now I've seen generations of fellows who've graduated. So I have a better understanding of, you know, this fellowship focuses on this particular thing, and they have a couple of surgeons who are excellent in this area, or they're excellent clinicians in this one particular thing. So anyone who's gone through there and that's been their mentor, I have a good sense of what they've learned and what their philosophy is going to be. So with things like that, word of mouth is still one of the strongest, again, from some of the resources that I trust. And the other thing is that, you know, more and more now there's more and more letters after people's names. And I've gotten to the point where, I don't know how it is in your world, but I've gotten to the point where I don't recognize half of the initials or what they mean or what they stand for. And it doesn't mean that they're not valuable. It just means that I don't understand them. So I don't understand what the value is. I can't place a value on multiple letters. I need to understand what that degree or certification represents. So I have seen folks who've done a lot of training, acquired multiple certifications, and really haven't had that much clinical experience. And when it comes to judgment and patient care, that's not their strength. And, you know, it's hard to say, because I don't, you know, I'm not trying to slam people. I'm a huge believer in education. I spent a long time in academia and taught in a post-professional fellowship. But I do think that there's a balance. I mean, to me, if I was looking for someone to treat me, I'm looking for somebody who is well-educated, who stays current, who has interdisciplinary experience, because I'm very much an anti-silo person, and who has good clinical judgment and can build good patient rapport. Like, those are a lot of things. I joke with my orthopedic surgeon friends about, you know, we know, like, the guys who are in sports medicine know you can be an excellent surgeon. You can be a terrific surgeon in terms of skill set. You know, when you're in the OR with a patient, brilliant. But you can be a terrible team physician, because being a team physician is so much about management. You're managing players and agents. You're managing team personnel. You have to understand player contracts, and you have to understand seasonal calendars, and you have to understand how all of those things can factor into decisions you're making about an athlete with return to play, or, you know, all of the things that go into patient care. And so, you know, again, the best skill set in the world in one area doesn't necessarily translate. So I think all those things are really important, and your own experience drives that. And I imagine it's the same way for you too. As you gain experience, you start to identify the things that are really important to you, and then you seek those out.
Yeah. And I think for me, I probably come across bubbles of people or circles of people where you meet someone who's a great clinician or consultant, whatever their job is, and then you find out that they're really good friends and you didn't know about it with this other excellent person, other side of the world, mm-hmm. who does something different, but they have agreeable principles or values in how they approach their craft. And I guess their network or their shared thinking is probably what's brought them together. And you start to realize that a lot of these really good thinkers all tend to know each other. So I tend to find although I said to you, you're not allowed to say networking effect.
I know. There is. I was going to say, you just identified networking, but I think it's really important. I don't know that, goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the way you conduct conversation dialogue and discourse, because I have seen people burn bridges early, and that becomes problematic later when you are doing this most important thing of networking. You know, that is one of the things that you don't know how many people are all interconnected. And so it's wise to just, you know, keep that in mind, because you never know when that circle is going to come back, that loop is going to close. So, it's important.
I promise for the rest of the conversation, I won't say, you know, answer this question without answering it. ban you from the actual answer. So I'll let you answer freely from this point on. Inform Performance is proudly partnered with Team Builder, a strength and conditioning software for performance coaches that is full of tools to help support you in your daily role. Whether it's building programs, tracking workout progress, or monitoring athlete wellness, load management, and fatigue, they've got you covered. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code INFORM to start your 30-day free trial. you recently wrote an article on turf as a playing surface, which is forever a hot topic in the industry and out of the industry as well for fans too. Can you give us the kind of an overview of the history of this debate, maybe just bring us up to speed on why this has come about or why you wrote the article?
Well, I wrote it because I spent a lot of time covering the NFL, and it's certainly been a more hot button topic the last couple of years. And maybe because I also tend to like inflicting punishment on myself and picking topics where I know they're going to be controversial, and all those things we talked about at the beginning, where you're going to just receive all the arrows when they come at you, because people feel so strongly. It's very polarizing. And whenever there's something like this, where there's injury talk around it, it's a health and safety topic, and it's polarizing, and people seem to be completely opposed, or it's a very hot button topic, and there's a lot of emotion around it, but there's not a lot of actual, you know, digging in and science and answers, then I become really interested in it. And so the last few years I've been paying attention to this in the NFL. The question has really been, what's better playing surface, natural grass or synthetic? So one of the things I've learned, by the way, over the course of doing this, for my people who are in the industry, is that turf relates to all fields, and it's either natural or synthetic, but that turf really in their world relates to everything. So there's natural grass and there are synthetic surfaces. And we've often seen the debate about which is safer framed that way, like it's a binary thing. And in actuality, there's this multitude of variables when you are looking at either surface. For example, when you're looking at grass, it's the type of grass. You know, people have heard of Bermuda grass. Think about if you live in different parts of the country, different parts of the world, what kind of grass you can grow. So the type of grass and how easy it is to maintain, what conditions it grows under, because depending on where your stadium or your field is, how difficult is it to maintain the quality of the field, given the grass that you have, and, you know, climate, cold, warm, etc. And then within the synthetics, I don't know how many people are aware, I certainly wasn't until I started digging into it, that really we're talking about more of a carpet-like structure. They roll these synthetic surfaces out, big, giant rolls, and the backing on the bottom looks like when you lift up your carpet and you see that kind of sticky backing. and it's stitches of synthetic fibers through it. So there are different what they call stitch gauges, and the number of fibers that come up through the surface at any one point. There's monofilament, where there's like one blade coming up, or multifilament, and then the shape of and the width of those filaments is different. And then that's just the grass, and then the pile height, how tall, short, how close the stitching is together can dictate part of the surface. And then the infill, which is the complement to it. So it's kind of the dirt to the grass, if you will. And I think people are mostly familiar with the little rubber pellets that you see now, like the black rubber combined with sand. But there's actually companies that are making organic mixes. So it's not rubber now. Things like corn, and I've heard of some other different clean infill, as they're called. So if you think about all of the different variables, and you know, even the infill blend, for example, how much proportion is sand? How much rubber do you use? How do you sift it out? How often do they groom the field? What, you know, the synthetic surfaces aren't just lay it down and let it go. They have to manage that surface. Even when you play a sport on it, that infill gets kicked up. Does the surface get damaged? Then you have the shock absorbing pad underneath it, if you have one of those or not. So, you know, you get the idea. There's just a multitude of variables. When you start mix and matching the combinations, it becomes a lot harder to say, okay, an injury is tied specifically to synthetic or natural grass. And really, when we're looking at lower extremity injuries, we're looking at how easily does the cleat release from the surface. So there's a whole component of that that is footwear. And we're not even getting into that. That's one thing, because the footwear and the cleat and the type of shoe and all of that can play a part in these lower extremity non-contact injuries. But as far as the surface itself, one of the big things we're looking at is the grippiness. You know, if the cleat doesn't release because it engages with that surface and the surface doesn't allow an easy release, the lower extremity is going to suffer. And so that's kind of what my interest in looking at all this is. And the NFL has tracked injury rates and started to dive much deeper into what actually happens at the level of the surface. And that's why I wrote the article. And this past year was the first year that this device that has been developed in the lab, they'd only previously used in the lab, was now mobile. It's called the Beast. And it looks like a tractor. Looks like something you see out on a farm, but inside it is housed all this fancy stuff, engineering, calibration, the motor that operates. There's an artificial cleat that basically, like the leg of the machine, comes down into the grass, and they can create they can measure the impact. They can look at a traction moment, like a sliding or a shear, a translational movement, or a rotation or torsional movement. And then all of that gets aggregated, sent up to the cloud, and they run these algorithms, and they can basically look at how that field surface is performing. And the field can be divided into all these little grids, so they can measure one quadrant. The whole purpose of taking it out in the field was so they could measure a quadrant over, you know, near the near end zone, for example, to a quadrant at the 50-yard line, or on the sideline down by the 20 on the opposite side. I mean, just so you can get an idea of how different parts of the field are behaving, because that's yet another dimension you can factor in here. So that's really what the article was talking about, was this new pilot study that started this past year, where they took the machine out into the different stadiums. They collected at least one sampling from each stadium that housed a synthetic surface last year, but four stadiums had a unit all year long, so they could take routine measurements and look over the course of the year. There's no data that we have available to us yet on what they discovered, but this is something that the joint engineering committees from the NFL and the NFLPA are looking at. And they said if they find anything, you know, that really stands out as an outlier, that's something they're going to push through up through committee as quickly as possible if they see an obvious change that should be made. But the next plan is to test grass surfaces next year and to continue to aggregate this data and see what they find out and see if they can get to a point where they can identify metrics that will lead us to the best combinations of field surfaces so that instead of having 30 different surfaces in the NFL like they feel they do now, they could have two or three and you would get consistency, which ultimately at the end of the day is what the athletes want. They want to know when I step on a field, am I going, you know, what is it going to feel like? And right now, any of these NFL players will tell you 1 week, I feel great playing over here. And the next week, I feel like I'm playing on cement. And then the third week, I feel like, it, you know, depending on what part of the field I'm on, it's terrible or it's good. And players like grass, but I will tell you that grass that doesn't hold up well, if it can't be well maintained, players are slipping and sliding all over the field. That's not good either. So you need to combine performance with health and safety considerations, and that's ultimately the goal.
Can this technology look at things like impulse as well, just to kind of see what kind of impact or ground reaction force players are getting as well? Or
that's part of it. I mean, there is, so right now, you know, they have the, and I haven't seen it done, so it's hard for me to fully describe it, but they do have these baseline measures that all fields have to conform to. And that has to do with the hardness. And it's some, basically, I feel like if I was, you know, using the language like the pen and paper, you know, or pencil and paper version of what this machine can do. But they have these things that are looked at before each game to make sure that a field meets the minimum standards for play. This machine can check those things as well. So it can look at hardness and impact of that cleat hitting the surface.
Yeah. And of course, this is only one part of the puzzle, isn't it? This is the environment. This mm-hmm. is the surface. If you're trying to if you're a team and you're trying to test a particular type of insole or shoe or cleat style for an athlete with an injury, and you don't know what the surface is like, nor the footwear, you've essentially got endless variables that to try and make sense of or not make sense of.
And it's interesting because the NFL has also, you know, and I know sometimes people are like, they must hear me and say, oh, it's funny, it's just, you know, mouthpiece for the NFL. But I say NFL, and really the NFL and the NFLPA, these projects are jointly piloted. The NFL has more money, and so they put in more money. But the decisions, the studies are constructed with scientists that are handpicked by both organizations. So, you know, the NFLPA picks their engineers, NFL picks their engineers. And I just want to make that clear because it's, I think, you know, there's always a lot of cynicism and suspicion about, oh, the league's doing this and that. But let's be honest, nobody else is doing the research. Like, there's nowhere else that is doing it. So at least we're going to start to get some information, and they're hopefully going to be able to work with other leagues. The NFL's talked about working with FIFA as they go through World Cup decisions to learn from them, because famously, FIFA has certain standards for the World Cup venues that involve natural grass, and they will be using some of the NFL stadiums. So there's been a lot of frustration, people saying, well, why can they put in this type of surface for a World Cup venue, but they can't do it for the NFL? That's a different conversation. But I think recognizing that not all sports have the same needs or demands, but understanding how a surface plays for a particular sport is also part of the learning. To your point about the footwear, they have looked also, I was at BioCore, which is the lab that works in collaboration. The engineers work in collaboration with the NFL. The NFL has funded a lot of research that happens there. But the lab is independent, and they have looked at, they have a couple of things they're looking at with footwear. They have, like, they look at the flex points. They have a machine that will take a shoe and do this flexing and bending of it repeatedly to see, you know, how and when it fails. And they have put different shoes on these turfs to see what that coefficient of friction is like, so they can compare one shoe to another. And actually, they've come up with a footwear guide that the NFL puts on their website, on their health and safety website. Anyone could go find it, but it lists out how the different shoes have performed in those tests. Now, what we don't have is that shoe for every single kind of surface. So, you know, there's some there's some generalization that is happening there. But what the lab at UVA, which is across the street from BioCore, a lot of BioCore splintered off and became a private lab. But a lot of the engineers at UVA are also doing turf studies. And I spent some time over there with them. And they are now doing the first, they have a robot that also has a cleat, and they can create different angles at which the cleat is impacting by putting the leg down. And they have a 3D printed cleat that they have, sort of looking at different, you know, kind of aggregate of body weights and things. So they come up with this average NFL player cleat, but approaching the surface from different angles and movement. So it's hard to visualize, you know, we're talking, I know nobody can see this, but there's a video in my article, if you go look at it, of the beast, so you can get an idea of what that's doing. This robot, hopefully, we are still working on a TV feature to come out later this year that hopefully will have some more of this other video in it. But this robot they have at UVA is looking at different angles, because we know players aren't always impacting the ground straight on, right? So they're coming in at different angles and turning and rotating. And they, for the first time, are getting natural grass samples so they can look at how that robot foot and cleat is interfacing with natural grass versus other types of synthetics. So they are looking at footwear as well, but the surface is getting a lot of attention because if you think about it, there's so much money spent on it, and stadiums have to change these out every few years anyway. And, you know, some of the research led to a big change that's happening this year. The Vikings and the Bengals were the last two teams to have what they call a slit film surface. And that surface had really stood out when they looked at injury rates as being less safe. And now it will be gone from the NFL. The last two stadiums are replacing their fields as we're talking right now. So, you know, the change is happening. Everybody wants all the answers right away. And you know how it is. You start asking a question, you get a couple answers, it leads you to 50 more questions that you need to answer. And so I don't know that they're going to come down to a single point that's going to satisfy everyone. But hopefully there will be some data points that emerge that say, this is where we should direct our attention, and these are the kind of things we should focus on when.
And I would definitely hope that our audience, which is largely obviously professional in the industry, I'd hope that they will appreciate the nuance rather than expecting you to give the silver bullet answer. Although I will admit that midway through you talking about it, I was thinking, I wonder what she's going to say is the best surface. But I'll be open.
The answer really right now is that we don't know. We know what a bad one, a really bad one, at least, you know, and I say bad for as far as how it's performed on published data on injury rates and NFL players. Might be useful and appropriate for other things, but the NFL has recommended to its clubs based on the data. Like, they basically present the data and say, hey, this is what we're seeing. But to your point, yes, if I have any, hope for doing this, it's that I hope people understand that the argument is more complex than just a binary equation. That's really what I hope for, is that people will talk about it. And if they hear other people saying, oh, well, you know, why don't they just get rid of all the turf surfaces? Everything should be grass. That they stop them and say, well, wait a minute, it's more complicated than that. That's what I hope.
Yeah. And I think it's great because, I mean, I know other sports will probably people listening to this show will probably from other sports will piggyback on the knowledge or start to follow this, even though, you know, different sport, different animal, perhaps if you're soccer, football in Europe or rugby or something. But it definitely is thought provoking and it's definitely usable, even if it is a different sport. There's definitely some transfer.
I would say, too, that one of the things that struck me when I was reporting on this is that, you know, both the NFL and the NFLPA are interested in the player feedback. They collected player feedback after games. What did you think of the surface? Why did you like it or not? They've done that for the last 2 years because they recognize that players feel differently after playing on different surfaces. And sometimes they will say, oh, my joints were killing me for 4 days. It was hard to walk after playing at Stadium X. And when I played Stadium Y, I don't feel that way. But what nobody has established yet is whether there's an injury correlation to how something feels. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It means that it hasn't been looked at yet enough to know whether there is a correlation. And if there isn't a correlation, it doesn't mean that how the player feels isn't important, because that actually is really important. So when they're looking at how do you find that ideal surface, it's a combination of how does a player feel when they're there and how are they able to perform? And then what's the safety component? And then also fiscally, what's the maintenance required on that surface? And is that sustainable? Because something that might work in one climate or somewhere with a closed roof might not work somewhere else. So where can you be flexible if you start finding these data points that tell you these are the ideal metrics for a playing surface for the NFL, for example?
Yeah, it's hard to picture the Bills and the Dolphins using the same turf and getting the exact same conditions out of it, just the dramatic change in climate.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny because maybe they will find out that there is something that what's interesting to me about this is that you're seeing some of the turf companies really get on board. And when I first went down to the UVA lab, of course, the PT in me was like, why did they build this? If this wasn't going to be, you know, people don't like it, or there's injury risk. And they reminded me like these weren't designed with that in mind, because nobody was thinking that way. They were thinking, what is going to be a durable surface? What's going to be something that will hold up to these stadiums that have multi-use demands? It's not just playing football on it. You're not going to be able to afford a stadium with, you know, 17 games a year. You have concerts in there. You have all these other things. So how is the surface going to hold up when you have a multi-use stadium? Or can the surface be covered, or whatever it is that you're going to ask? So there is a fiscal component to it. And I don't think that it's irresponsible to consider that amongst the other things. But I think now these turf companies are looking at, okay, how can we combine what we need for player performance? And yep, everybody's looking at health and safety now. So now we need to take that into consideration. And oh, by the way, it has to be not completely out of the realm of what we can afford to manufacture it or what people are going to be willing to buy.
That's very interesting. Well, I'm very aware of time. Obviously, you're on Twitter, but can you just share where the best place is for people to find you, the article, and everything we've spoken about?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Twitter, X, at @Stefania_ESPN. And on Instagram at Stefania Bell. So I usually post most of my work things in those two spots. I am on Threads as well with the same Stefania Bell. And the turf article, if you go to ESPN.com/NFL, if you go to the NFL page, you search for the Beast with, you know, I think I put in keywords today like Beast and turf and surface and all of those things. You'll find it. You could just find it on the internet, but I know it's on the Vikings page and the NFL page on ESPN.com. And that's where most of my work shows up, my written work anyway.
Well, thank you for debunking myths on both your professional background, but then also the hotly debated turf topic as well. So yeah, thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.